WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We often hear that we're suffering from a shortage of good leaders. Gary Will says we have many good leaders, but they're not necessarily in electoral politics. Some of our best recent leaders, he says, have been in the civil rights movement, the women's movement, business, and religion. Wills analyzes different leadership styles in his new book, Certain Trumpets, The Call of Leaders. He won a Pulitzer Prize for his previous book, Lincoln at Gettysburg. I asked Wills about President Clinton's leadership style. Wills says, as a governor, Clinton had to be very accommodating to the legislature to push his bills through. In national government, he may be too anxious to please his enemies.
It's very useful to a leader, a political leader, often, to have the right enemies. Take Richard Nixon. Now, here's a man who is not tremendously warm or likable in himself, but he had very loyal followers, and many of those were followers because of the enemies he had made. They followed him less because they thought Richard Nixon was warm and wonderful and ideal than because they thought that demonstrators in the street were tearing down the society and he was able to stand up to them, willing to stand up to them, snarl back at them. So even his meanness or his mean streak that came out at times was something that some of those followers treasured. They thought, well, he won't put up with these rioters, these demonstrators, these anti-war peaceniks. So choosing your enemies and using them well is a gift that politicians often have to have, and Bill Clinton doesn't seem to want to have any enemy.
And you think that's getting in his way?
I think it will, or may, in the future, yeah.
In your new book, there's a chapter about Eleanor Roosevelt, and you describe her as a reform-oriented leader. How would you compare Eleanor Roosevelt to Hillary Clinton as first ladies?
Well, again, there's a work in progress in the case of Hillary Clinton. In some ways, Eleanor Roosevelt was more outrageous and got away with more. For instance, she insisted on being paid for everything she wrote as the president's wife. And not only that, she ran a radio show which had commercial sponsors. Now you would never get away with that, it seems to me. On the other hand, she was very cautious about anything that might embarrass her husband. For instance, everybody knows that she protested the DAR's exclusion of Marian Anderson from their hall. But when Marian Anderson went on to give her concert at the Lincoln Memorial, Eleanor, at the request of Lewis Howe, did not go. Howe said this would be going too far and it would embarrass Franklin. So she didn't do it. And in other cases, she would trim and hedge. And I don't think that was wrong in her case. It would do her no good to damage her husband so that he couldn't be reelected, for instance. It would do no good to her causes. So that's one of the points of my book, that there is not one ideal of leadership, that you don't have to have hard principle, refusal to compromise as the only kind of leadership. It's one kind, and a very important kind, but there are other kinds.
Compare Eleanor Roosevelt to Hillary Clinton.
Well, Eleanor Roosevelt was very bright and self-taught, but she was unhappy about her lack of formal education. She went to finishing school rather than normal kinds of college, and she always felt that she was not as educated as some of her associates and as she wished. And that made her, in some ways, less confident about herself. And it made her trim to an unnecessary degree. For instance, she would disclaim ability to talk about policy. She did finally get around to doing it in various ways, but she could have done it without that disclaimer if she'd had a little more self-confidence. The times are different now. Not only is Hillary Clinton trained, educated, very well educated as a lawyer, she had a professional career and standing on her own. Now, Eleanor Roosevelt was a professional in some ways. She was a writer, she was a teacher before she became the president's wife. But she didn't have a professional training or status, and she didn't have a women's movement that had reached the condition that the one has now, where not only Hillary Clinton, but most of the candidates who are coming along now have professional wives. A number of the presidential candidates running last time out had lawyer wives. So she's not a unique phenomenon. She's not alone in the way that Eleanor was.
You use Ross Perot as your example of a good business leader. Why did you use Ross Perot to epitomize good business leadership?
Because he's in the great tradition of salesmanship, which is glorified by our business tradition. The entrepreneur who not only can invent something, lots of people can do that, but who can go out and sell it. Henry Ford was not only good at tinkering in his shop, but even better at coming up with sales gimmickry. So most of our business heroes have been people in the sales department. He knows how to dramatize himself and his product and his workers, and he commanded tremendous loyalty among his original workers, his EDS workers, before he sold them. So as a mobilizer, both of people to sell his product and of buyers to buy it, he was spectacular. So I treat him in that career. I don't treat him in the political career, because that's a different type that other people exemplify better.
I think as part of the preparation for your book, you spent some time in bookstores in the business section looking at the inspirational books on how to become a great business leader. Did you learn anything interesting by looking at these books?
Well, I learned the vulnerability of people in business, because almost all of them are therapeutic. They encourage. They say, don't get discouraged. Don't worry if people won't respond to you. Because after all, salespeople and people who are pushing a product get rejected and turned down. Fewer people buy the product than say, no, I won't buy it, no matter how good the product is. So a lot of it is simply hand-holding, and the better business people have understood that and have created morale by a kind of group psyching up, you know, these annual sales conferences and rewards and team projects and sales courses in which you learn how to overcome resistance and rejection.
You know, there's a book coming out in the spring or the fall that will be called Jesus Christ CEO. That will have lessons for business leaders about what they can learn from Christ's life.
Well, you know, what we know from Christ's life is a very distant report. And even in those reports, namely the Gospels written by his disciples a fair amount of time after his death, even those reports make him out to be a failure during his life. So he's hardly a model of success. He was rejected. He was humiliated. He was killed. And even his followers fled from him, and they write that down themselves. So he's a mysterious theological event. And if you are a believer in him, as I am, by the way, I'm a Catholic, you believe that he failed in his life and he succeeded after death by entirely supernatural means. So I wouldn't take him as a model.
Gary Wills is my guest. His new book about leadership is called Certain Trumpets. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about leadership with Gary Wills. You write that intellectual leaders are very rare. Now, why are they so rare?
Well, because there's something in the intellectual life that tends towards solitude, toward thinking, toward following a line of thought no matter where it takes you. And the more refined and rarefied your thinking becomes, the harder it is to communicate it just at random to lots of people. So the truly innovative thinker, the David Hume in his thought, the Plato, these are people who tend to become isolated from followers, and then popularizers come along who take their thought when it's less original, when it's been absorbed by some followers, and they tend to popularize it, and those are the intellectual leaders. So a William Buckley who takes conservative thought and tries to get people to mobilize to vote for the Republican Party because of some kind of principled intellectual position, he's a leader. But some of his sources were not leaders, although they were great thinkers.
You know, in your book, you try to sort out the different types of leaders that we have and the different leadership styles that they use. And you say that there's a very old belief that democracy is actually incompatible with good leadership. Would you explain that seeming contradiction?
Well, yes. If the people make their own decisions, as one view of democracy is, and the elected representative just carries out those decisions, then, of course, the people are not being led. They are leading their leaders, in effect. They're giving orders to the person who is their representative. That's a simplistic view of democracy, as I say, but it's one that's often brought up, that if a leader is simply following what the people say, he can't be leading. Of course, the dialogue is much more complex, because the people don't really say what they think should be done. There's not a machinery that makes that possible. Political theory has long explored the fact that you can't pose a question in such a way that a simple yes or no will represent what people actually think about it. If you say, for instance, should we go to war in Haiti, and you have people vote on that, well, some of those who say we should would say it under such complex conditions that it would be impossible to carry out, and carry along with you some of the other people who had voted for that. So a leader in a democracy has to reframe the questions and ask people again what they think in various ways, and try to lead them by framing the question in answerable ways. For instance, Abraham Lincoln knew that he could not simply propose to the electorate, should we free the slaves? He would be rejected. So he found ways of saying, well, should slaves be equal? And they would say, no, I don't want to be, should blacks be equal? And then he would say, well, what happens, though, to the Declaration of Independence, which says all men are created equal? And they say, well, in a way, that's true. And so he built on that. And he said, well, I'm not after social equality. I'm at least saying one man should not own another man. Would you say that's something that would fit under the Declaration of Independence? So he was reframing the question in ways that he could get some kind of an answer that would move him along the way toward emancipation. So that's the kind of dialogue that goes on. And, of course, he has to be paying very close attention to them and knowing what he can get them to respond to and what he can't.
Dan Quayle has a new book out and is traveling around the country, using that as an opportunity to, I think, try to present a different image of himself. How would you describe him as a leader?
Well, we had very little opportunity to know, because his own administration kept him under wraps most of the time, which is what he complains about in his book, apparently. I haven't read it yet. As a senator, he was not bad. And, you know, people forget that he won his debates when he ran for Congress and when he ran for the Senate. And the Senate debate was against Birch Bayh, a formidable opponent. So perhaps we saw a different Dan Quayle in the national arena the first time around.
Bob Dole would perhaps like to be the next president. Your thoughts on him?
Well, he's not very successful in going out and meeting large groups of people. I think he's obviously a legislative leader and very good at that, respected, hardworking. But his skills in meeting and attracting audiences in the broader arena are still untested, I think.
So those are two really different kinds of leadership.
Sure.
They've tried to mobilize the public.
Look at Lyndon Johnson as a legislative leader and Lyndon Johnson as a president. It shows the difference in the kinds of leadership that were entailed.
In thinking about what we want from our leaders, on the one hand, we want them to be behind, to be in their offices making important decisions all the time. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, they need to be mobilizing popular support and everything. Sometimes I turn on C-SPAN and Warren Christopher's on all the time, or Bill Clinton's making a speech every day, and I wonder, how do they get anything done?
Well, it is a trade-off. You have to do your homework, but you also have to keep the people informed and responsive and interested. It's a difficult task. One of the funny things is that Franklin Roosevelt was very good at that, because in a way he was so immobilized that he had to think up ways to reach out to people without having to get out of the office and get out of his chair and get out from behind his desk. So he tailored his press conferences and his fireside chats and his appearances to a kind of economy of what can I do to get the most public response for the least amount of physical exertion, because I'm not up to a lot of physical exertion. And maybe presidents should think more in those terms, that because they're able to jump on Air Force One and go wherever they want anytime they want, they probably tend to do it too much.
Mm-hmm. After Nixon died, you had an op-ed piece, and I think it was the New York Times, in which you described Nixon as a small, bitter man and a very grand diplomat. you know, trying to point out the paradoxes of Nixon's personality as a leader. I'm sure you watched a lot of the funeral coverage and the speeches afterwards and so on. Do you think there was a lot of rewriting of Nixon as, yes, as a leader and a person? I just wonder what went through your mind watching everything that was said and written about him after his death.
Well, I think it was his last trick. I think it was really, he was proving himself a resurrectionist again. What's fascinating about Nixon is that he engaged people so deeply, so emotionally, in hatred or pity or responses of solidarity with him, that there's always been a kind of volatility and emotional lightning atmosphere around him. And I think that came out, that people over-responded to the fact that he was dead and couldn't be kicked around anymore. So instead of kicking him around, they cosseted him around. There's already been a reaction to that. He will never lie at rest as something distant from us as long as those of us who lived through his time are alive and our emotions are still engaged.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Gary Will's new book is called Certain Trumpets, The Call of Leaders. This is Fresh Air.